Coming up, Lucky Severson reports on the struggles over Islam at three North Carolina universities. Also, Judy Valente on the power and future of sacred music.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernathy. It's good to have you with us. This week, people of faith in Baltimore prayed for peace and justice as the city's six-day curfew came to an end following last week's riots. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan attended a mass in the West Baltimore neighborhood that the late 25-year-old Freddie Gray called home. President Obama referred to the unrest in Baltimore while he was in New York, promoting a program to help young minority men. He spoke of his long-standing commitment to racial justice.
And this will remain a mission for me and for Michelle, not just for the rest of my presidency, but for the rest of my life.
In Nepal, religious groups continue to pray for and deliver aid to the victims of the devastating earthquake there. Relief workers are facing various challenges, including a lack of clean water and the threat of spreading disease. Approximately 8,000 people have died, a number that's expected to rise. Many of Nepal's ancient temples and World Heritage sites were also damaged or destroyed. Amid calls for contributions to help Nepal earthquake victims, humanitarian groups are urging donors not to ignore other ongoing crises, especially the millions of Syrian and Iraqi refugees who need assistance. Kim Lawton reports on one Hollywood power couple trying to help.
Reality TV producer Mark Burnett and his wife, actress Roma Downey, have developed several highly successful Bible epics for television and the big screen. Their most recent project, AD, The Bible Continues, tells the story of the apostles' efforts to spread Christianity after Jesus' death. It has been airing this spring on NBC. After hearing reports of Christian communities in Iraq and Syria being targeted by ISIS, late last year, the Burnetts launched the Cradle of Christianity Fund, a project to help refugees fleeing the violence. They donated the first $1 million.
We have managed through our fund to help 72,000 Christians get through the harsh Syrian winter. Imagine surviving the persecution and the threat of death, only to freeze to death.
With winter now over, they are supporting efforts to help the refugees find more permanent living situations. As Christians, they say they're very concerned about the future of their faith in the lands where it first took hold. But Burnett says the Bible stories he's retelling in his miniseries show reasons for hope as well.
It's amazing that the Romans weren't able just to kill the 12 apostles and stop Jesus' message. And instead, those 12 guys took down Rome.
I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
In Nigeria, women and children receive treatment at a refugee camp after being rescued from Boko Haram by the Nigerian military. Last week, the Nigerian army said it freed 700 people who'd been held by the militant group. Many survivors have been sharing testimonies of the horrors they said they saw and experienced while in captivity, including torture and forced marriages. Many of the girls who were rescued were reported to be pregnant. So far, those rescued do not seem to include any of the 200 schoolgirls who received international attention when they were kidnapped last year. ISIS has claimed responsibility for last weekend's shooting attack at a controversial exhibit near Dallas, Texas. Two gunmen were shot and killed by police after they opened fire at an event featuring caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. The gunmen were reported to have been inspired by ISIS, but their relationship to the group, if any, is unknown. The exhibit was organized by activist Pamela Geller, who's been criticized as anti-Islamic. The Council on American-Islamic Relations condemned the attack, saying, "Bigoted speech can never be an excuse for violence." We have a Lucky Severson story today on three North Carolina universities, Duke, Wake Forest, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, struggling to overcome hostility toward Islam, hostility that in one instance was deadly.
About a billion Muslims around the world answer the call to prayer each day. So when Duke University, founded by Methodists and Quakers, announced that it would broadcast the call once each Friday from its Gothic church bell tower, it was hailed as a positive step toward religious and cultural diversity. This is a Duke PR video.
Duke has provided the Muslim community with a Muslim life that is far more comprehensive than many other universities in the entire U.S.
Then Duke, in a turnabout, canceled its plan. That was one in a series of episodes at three North Carolina universities that has caused Muslims in the region to be fearful of an upsurge of Islamophobia. Imam Khalid Griggs is a Muslim chaplain at Wake Forest University.
You know, actually, this is the worst period for Islamophobia since 2001. This is a very cancerous formation that is rooted in racism and bigotry, anti-immigration feelings, and is so un-American.
And then there are those like Donald Woodsmall, a Wake Forest-educated lawyer and businessman, who is worried about what he thinks is the true intention of some Muslims living in the U.S.
Let's say I get an email from someone and they say, "You're a bigot." I simply say, "All I'm doing is repeating facts. That's all I'm doing. I'm just like the little boy who's saying the king doesn't have any clothes on."
Woodsmall says the king, in this case, is Imam Griggs and his belief in Sharia law and personal jihad, which is why Woodsmall emailed 24,000 Wake Forest alumni asking them to withhold donations to the university.
And what I'm asking for is a debate on Sharia and whether it's compatible with American constitutional principles. That's my goal.
Michelle Browers was one of the first supporters of the imam. She's an associate professor of political and international affairs at Wake Forest.
And it wasn't until someone left a bucket of urine outside his door that we realized it had gone up from verbal harassment, fabrications told about Imam Griggs, to actually physically harassing him.
And then the president of Wake Forest, Nathan Hatch, took a stand firmly behind Imam Griggs and against Donald Woodsmall's demand.
He's offered a frontal attack against Imam Griggs and his associations and what he believes. And Imam Griggs doesn't stand for that. I mean, he's been in this community for 30 years. We know that he is a man of peace. We know the influence, the positive influence he has in his mosque and on students. So we just think those criticisms are deeply unfair.
When Charlie Hebdo happened in Paris, that same week, 2,000 women and children were killed in Nigeria by Islamic fundamentalists. And then I ask him, how many people have to die around the world at the hands of Sharia supremacists before you would feel comfortable debating this subject on the Wake Forest campus?
Imam Griggs says he does support Sharia law, as do all practicing Muslims in one form or another, depending on the culture and country.
It's a Muslim code of conduct that encompasses from the time a Muslim wakes up what they should do, what they should say, and praising God and these kinds of things, but it's for Muslims.
Woodsmall's biggest complaint about the imam and Sharia law is the meaning of jihad.
You don't have to dig very deep before you understand what jihad is, and I think America has woken up and understands what jihad is.
To Woodsmall and many Americans, jihad has a very violent connotation associated with terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The beheadings by ISIS in particular have had a dramatic effect on the American psyche. Safia Usmani has a very different view. She's a Pakistani master's student in documentary at Wake Forest, a Fulbright scholar, and a Muslim. Her latest film is about the term jihad.
The idea is to educate the people about the real meaning behind jihad, which is to struggle. It is to look within and struggle to make your life better. And I feel like I really need to do this. It's my attempt to sort of reclaim the word jihad.
The film features a Muslim student who embarks on two jihads. One is to educate the community about Islam.
And then he's having his personal jihad. And he was so inspired that 2 weeks ago he had a baby boy and he named him Kareem Jihad.
The term itself is taken from the root jihada. Just simply means struggle. And there are different forms of struggle. In the United States and around the world, particularly in the English-speaking world, jihad has been mistranslated as holy war.
He has a place of recruitment, he has a position of authority and a lot of influence to recruit more, you know, I'll call them confused students.
Safia says she is definitely not confused.
The note that we're ending the film on is that it's not just my jihad or just your jihad alone, but as a society, it's our collective jihad to make this world a much healthier, happier, and a safer place for our kids to come.
There was another incident that amplified the fear of Muslims that they are increasingly the target of Islamophobia. This one in February, when three Muslim students at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill were shot to death, apparently, police say, over a parking place.
Tell me how my son is. What's his situation? If he's dead, tell me he's dead.
But the husband, sister, and father are convinced it was a hate crime.
6 weeks ago, I cried tears of joy at my baby brother's wedding. Today we are crying tears of unimaginable pain over the execution-style murders of my brother Dia, his bride Yusuf, and her younger sister and best friend Razan.
Each one of these children had a bullet in the head. This was an execution style. This was a hate crime from a neighbor.
Do you think it was all about parking places?
No, I don't believe it was all about parking spaces.
This is Chapel Hill Mayor Mark Kleinschmidt.
What we have here is someone who is engaging with people who are different than him, and it was easier, perhaps, to respond in a violent way than it would have been with other people.
According to his wife, the suspect, Craig Stephen Hicks, wasn't targeting Muslims. She said he railed against all religions. The family believes it was a hate crime and that it was because the two sisters were wearing hijabs, headscarves.
We are not seeking any revenge.
The federal and local investigation into the shooting is ongoing, but Mayor Kleinschmidt says Muslims in the area are afraid that it was a hate crime.
We have folks who worship here in Chapel Hill who refrain from publicizing and making it known where they worship when they come together. And they tell me it's because they have concerns about their safety.
At Duke, when the announcement about the call to prayer from the church bell tower was suddenly canceled, Duke PR explained it this way.
Initially, the call for prayer was to occur from the top of the chapel. That announcement generated questions and concerns from the Duke community that led the university to rethink its original plan.
What the PR film doesn't mention is that the cancellation came one day after the Reverend Franklin Graham posted this on his Facebook page. It said, in part, as Christianity is being excluded from the public square and followers of Islam are raping, butchering, and beheading Christians, Jews, and anyone who doesn't submit to their Sharia Islamic law, Duke is promoting this in the name of religious pluralism. Duke discouraged professors and staff from speaking with us, saying the university wants to move on. But Franklin Graham's post has contributed to the worries of Muslims in this country. Many believe his sentiments are becoming more common and leading to increased discrimination and hostility against the people who themselves have been the primary victims of terrorism. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
We have a story now on Yale University's Institute of Sacred Music. The musicians there are devoted to both the aesthetic and spiritual power of church music. Judy Valente reports.
The musical tastes of most 20-somethings trend along these lines: Beyoncé, Maroon 5, and hip-hop artist Mark Ronson. 'Cause Uptown Funk
don't give it to you. So willed my father now at rest.
But for 28-year-old tenor Gene Stenger, there are no song lyrics or musical beats that compare with a Handel oratorio.
The harmonies are gorgeous, and the melodies are incredible to sing. And I think even the context of the historical context of it is also what interests me.
This is Yale's Institute of Sacred Music, a place dedicated to turning out the next generation of liturgical composers, choristers, conductors, and organists.
We exist to integrate theological education and musical education with artistic education. At the same time, they study music, they study art history, they study the Bible, they study Christian theology, literature, poetry, architecture, liturgy.
Instructors like Thomas Troger represent the Institute's overall approach. Troger is a theologian, flautist, hymn writer, and poet.
There was an idea very popular a few decades ago where people thought what we've got to do is we've got to extract the religion so we just have the art. But in recent years, more and more scholars have become very interested in realizing, wait a minute, that's kind of a distortion, in that you have no idea of the real depth if you take out the theology. And call the brave
and only brave. Gene Stenger considers his singing a calling, a way to inspire a sense of the divine in audiences. By the age of 21, Stenger had already performed as a soloist Bach's Magnificat and St. Matthew Passion and Handel's Messiah.
Anytime that I'm performing Handel's Messiah, I feel a very strong spiritual connection. And for me, it's almost like a form of prayer. And to be able to incorporate my passion of music into that is something very special.
5 days a week, classwork stops at 10:30 in the morning, and at Yale's Marquand Chapel, the community gathers for sung morning prayer.
Hallelujah.
Led by the Institute's students.
There is something about the experience of a big group of people singing together and really singing from the bottom of their hearts. And it does something to you that lifts us out of our sort of intellectual pursuits that we do all day long.
The prayer service offers a variety of sacred music styles. It also showcases the talents of both faculty and students, like Kenyon Adams, who writes and performs his own gospel hymns.
I say to them, I'd like you to bring the thing that you do, and we will work the chapel around what you have to bring.
The student body represents a variety of religious traditions, a point of pride for the Institute.
We admit with an eye toward diversity. We want our students to look different from each other. And that immediately suggests that they're going to think differently.
Turn to God and draw a blessing.
27-year-old Edmund Milley was raised Presbyterian and sometimes felt uncomfortable being in other churches until music became a bridge.
That tension becomes less and less relevant to my life as it goes on. We are all there to do the same thing, which is to render this piece of music in the most beautiful and the most affecting way for everyone who's present.
My mom is Buddhist, and I actually grew up going to temple, and I really like a lot of values in Christianity, too, so I'd say I'm one of those figuring it out people, so.
A major part of the coursework is to give students real-world performance experience, like this Sunday evening concert at New York's famous St. Bartholomew Church. On the program is Handel's 18th-century oratorio, Judas Maccabeus, under the direction of the internationally known conductor, David Hill.
David Hill was genetically engineered to work at the Yale Institute of Sacred Music. David knows the liturgy like the back of his hand, knows scripture, knows the Psalms, knows the tradition, but he also has the musical skills to teach our very talented music students to be the very best artists they can be.
For students, the performances often prove to be powerful experiences, artistically and spiritually.
I really try to think about the character that I'm portraying and the text and what are the important words to bring out and put myself in that mindset of how this character is feeling.
There was this feeling about singing to a group of people and having music serve as an immediate spiritual function. It's that connection you have as a singer in sacred music to service to others that's unlike any other kind of service.
The performance opportunities that we give our students are primary laboratories for their learning. Not only do they have to, in a sense, bury themselves in a practice room to get really good at their skills, they have to share that with the public.
There is also the question about what these students will do with all of this training once they've graduated. But don't even try to suggest to first-year graduate student Jacob Street that his specialty, the organ, doesn't offer much of a musical future.
A friend recently compared it to The Wizard of Oz, that you're hearing all this sound and fury, but you're not actually seeing it all happen. There is an incredible palette of colors available to the organist, an incredible array, and it's different with every single instrument.
Street, who is 27, currently plays organ for a 60-member choir at a nearby Episcopal church. He knows that job may not last, but he loves the organ and the music written for it, so he refuses to get discouraged.
I don't expect to find the perfect job right away, but I also don't know that I'll be doing any one thing as a full-time job. So I'm very much prepared for doing a lot of different things to sort of cobble together a lifestyle. And I think that's part of the fun, actually, of being a musician.
The Lord worketh wonders.
Edmund Milley says he hopes to combine ensemble singing of classical pieces with solo work. Mindy Chu is interested in exploring ways of delivering classical sacred music to contemporary audiences like her peers.
Being a part of this movement of where classical music's going, how are we going to change it or alter it to deliver it to contemporary audiences? I would love to be a part of that movement.
Sound and alarm!
Gene Stenger also wants to pursue a career as a soloist, but he says he mainly wants to show audiences that the arts are not merely a means to entertain. They can be a pathway to the sacred, a vital source of spiritual strength and comfort, music especially. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in New Haven, Connecticut.
The Vatican has officially approved sainthood for Father Junipero Serra, the 18th century missionary who founded many missions in California. In Rome, Pope Francis celebrated Mass at an event in honor of Serra. Francis will canonize him during his trip to the U.S. in September, making Serra America's first Latino saint and the first saint to be canonized on American soil. Serra's sainthood has been controversial, with some critics saying he brutally converted indigenous people to Catholicism. The Pope also took time for a special audience this week with the Harlem Globetrotters. The Globetrotters made Francis the 9th honorary member of their team, and they even taught him a few tricks. In 2000, the team conferred the same honor on Pope John Paul II. Finally, on our calendar this week, Muslims observe Laylat al-Miraj. The holiday recalls the Prophet Muhammad's journey from Mecca to Jerusalem and his ascension from the Dome of the Rock to heaven, where he received the command from Allah that Muslims should pray 5 times a day. And on Thursday, many Western Christians observe Ascension Day, which commemorates the bodily ascension of Jesus into heaven. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. You can visit our website where there's more from our interview with producer Mark Burnett on his NBC series AD, The Bible Continues. You can also listen to or watch all of our programs. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the Yale Institute of Sacred Music.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.